According to the Wall Street Journal, decisions have all but been made that the United States is going to use military power against Venezuela, lethal military power against Venezuela. And the most logical and most plausible target is regime change to get Maduro out of power. Now, there could be a lot of other things to go on with that and a lot of claims that are being made, but we want to take a look today at the legality of it. Is this something that's authorized within the international law, within American law, within the U.S. Constitution? And man, do we have somebody good to try and ascertain that today. For the first time on our show, we have, Gary, if you could put that full button up there, Robert Barnes. Who is a trial lawyer with high profile wins for Clyde. Anytime you get a winner on, we love to have winners on there. Also, Viva Barnes Law on a podcast. So he's very often on there and first time on our show today. And we're really grateful to have you on.
Oh yeah. Happy to be here.
Well, listen, let's just jump right into it. A lot of things going on there. According to the Wall Street Journal, this is earlier today. Gary, if you could put that full screen up there. He said, ahead of a possible land strikes, the Trump administration has embarked on a messaging campaign to cast Maduro as the head of a drug trafficking enterprise that seeks to flood the United States with drugs. The charge Maduro has denied, of course. And without putting forth evidence, U.S. officials have also called Venezuela a central hub of terrorist activity and have claimed that Maduro's regime is running the cartels. Now, there was a lot of issues earlier this year where there was actually some conflicts within the administration in the Office of Director of National Intelligence, where they looked for a reading that was going to try and tie Trinidad Aragua to the Maduro regime, because then apparently that would allow Trump to attack the government. But at least according to what was released, they weren't able to do that. They said, well, no, there actually is no connection between the two, which left Trump pretty unhappy, and those analysts ended up getting fired. But the question at hand is, actually, there's two questions at hand. Let's look at them separately. First of all, there is the issue of the drug issue. Is Venezuela an actual drug hub? Is it like the center of all this, that taking something out there is going to protect the United States from getting all these illegal drugs in? So not sure if that's in your area of expertise, but what is your understanding?
Well, you know, our deep state script writers really need to improve. They decided that WMD didn't mean weapons of mass destruction. It just means weapons of mass drugs. And that's our new pretext, our new excuse. And Venezuela is as much a source of weapons of mass drugs as Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So the reality is that that's a joke. And you can go, as you pointed out, you can go no further than Director of National Intelligence under Trump, Tulsi Gabbard's report from March of this year, which said that the Venezuelan government was not a leading source of drug supply, that there may be military officials and police officials like our own country. We're busy indicting police officers in Mississippi as we speak for being drug traffickers. There may be those kind of people in Venezuela, but it is by no means institutionalized, and it is not the core source of any of it. There's no connect. I mean, they're even trying to draw connections between Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, you know, fentanyl. None of that has any connection to Venezuela. You know, Venezuela is a regime that is hostile to the American regime currently. There's been hostilities ever since we put in mass sanctions on them, which somehow never shows up in these articles. That a large part of the dispute between the U.S. and Venezuela is the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela that has helped bankrupt their economy, along with questionable management of their government. But there's really no substantial evidence that Venezuela is a primary source of drugs into the United States. And the allegations of fentanyl are just completely false and fabricated. It is a marginal source of drugs into the United States, not a major source. And of course, any kind of regime change effort is only likely to accelerate the amount of drugs that come through Venezuela, not decelerate. If we wanted to focus on a major source of drug supply in the history of the United States, we would be better off looking closer to, say, Langley than Caracas.
Yeah, good luck on that one. that's a point of contention to a lot of people that are concerned about that. But we'll address that part in another day. But right now, I want to focus on here because I think that we're going down a pretty dangerous place, in my view. And I want to kind of stick on this definitions issue, because one of the other things that especially Secretary of War Pete Hegseth has said a lot is that these guys are terrorists. They're like ISIS. They're like Al-Qaeda, and they're going to be treated as such. What do you make of that?
It is an attempt to borrow the language of terrorism law and terrorism precedents that other presidents have used to engage in effectively warfare without a declaration of war in contravention of the Constitution's requirement that Congress authorize such a war. And because so many of our presidents have seen that as a convenient pretext in the recent era, that they can go and bomb whomever, whenever, wherever, however, as long as they can just call them terrorists, is the political pretext for all of this. But pretending that some people in some boats that maybe did or didn't have drugs on them, that maybe were or were not headed to the United States, that maybe everybody there was culpable, maybe they weren't. The evidence, they have yet to present any public evidence that supports this, as the Wall Street Journal confirms. And when two people were found alive, did we indict them? No, we actually sent them back to their own home countries, which would suggest if these were actually narco-terrorists, would we release them? Would we release them back to their home country? Doesn't this suggest this is all bogus? This is all garbage, the latest pretext for the latest dumb foreign intervention? And, you know, I hear people say this is the Monroe Doctrine. Well, it was my old cousin, John Quincy Adams, who was Secretary of State at the time, who helped craft the Monroe Doctrine, who said, we do not go abroad searching for monsters to destroy. And yet that's all we've been doing for the better part of the last century since the end of World War II. The Monroe Doctrine was against foreign intervention, period, including our own. It was against the Spanish and Portuguese intervening. It wasn't, it's our right to intervene. That's nowhere in the declaration of the Monroe Doctrine. It was regime change. In fact, even outlined it. It said, often these countries do it, believing they're going to improve the well-being of the citizens of those countries, and it rarely works out that way. That's what President Monroe said at the time when he gave his seventh letter to Congress, which was the State of the Union, used to be by letter back in the day. So there's simply no evidence that I have seen of this. Under the constitutional standards, the president has the authority to do so without a declaration of war if it is in the imminent self-defense. It's like the same legal self-defense standard you or I would have. Is the same that the United States would have in taking these actions in international waters.
Right. Yeah. And that's one thing I wanted to zero in on, because that's how I, as I'm an Army guy, I'm certainly not a legal scholar, which is why we're happy to have you on today. But as I read the 1973 War Powers Act, there are only three conditions that the president of the United States can unilaterally take action against a foreign adversary, especially lethal military action in another country. And one of them is a declaration of war. One is an authorization by the military, by Congress. And the third one, and I think it's the only the other one, is that we have been attacked or it's something's imminent attack. And none of those things are at play here. So what then can be the justification? Because what they've said so far is, well, he's a drug guy. And they've claimed all this stuff, like the Wall Street Journal said, without evidence. But even if, let's say that was 100% true, does that allow them to use lethal military power?
Well, the way I apply it is a nation should have no greater right of self-defense than an individual. And the doctrine of self-defense is, let's say I'm in my neighborhood and I know that I believe there's a drug dealer down the street, and that drug dealer is trying to provide drugs to save my child. Does that give me the right to go down and shoot them in the head? The answer is no. There is no court, no jury that would say that is self-defense. That means it's not self-defense for us to do it either. And there's no better evidence that they know that than the fact that when any of them survive, we don't even arrest them. We don't indict them. We don't even detain them. We don't send them to Gitmo. We send them back to their home country. So we really know that we don't have a substantial self-defense. What they're really relying upon is the Congress failing to do its job over the last half century in policing presidential abuse of power. But in my view, there is no constitutional justification for these attacks, just like there would be no constitutional justification for further attacks, as apparently is planned, according to the Wall Street Journal, on the land of Venezuela.
Now, there was a question, or I guess it was basically a conference in the White House the other day, where President Trump and the Secretary of War, Tulsi Gabbard, was also there. And I think the Homeland Security Secretary was there. And one of the questions that he was asked, President Trump, was, they said, hey, if you're declaring war on these cartels and all that you're doing, why not just actually have a declaration and go to Congress and get that if that's what you're looking for? Here's how he answered.
I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay? We're going to kill them.
Okay, point blank. Does the president of the United States have that authority?
No, he does not. The Constitution doesn't afford a broad roving assassination authority to the president. There's executive orders that have been signed banning that the president has not reversed, I would note, prohibiting assassinations overseas. There's congressional laws that limit this even further. And so there isn't. And then if we were to look at international law, it too abhors it. I mean, essentially, the president's going down the former president of the Philippines route, and he's sitting up in The Hague awaiting trial in the ICC for taking the exact same steps, saying, hey, I'm just going to execute drug dealers in the Philippines. And that's why
Duterte, Duterte is, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why he's now there. Amongst, there might have been some other geopolitical factors in play, too, with the dispute with the Marcos family and all that. But that's why he's there legally. And the president's doing the same thing. I mean, he's setting, if the Democrats are to take back the House, he's giving them a very easy impeachment case. And I think unnecessarily so. It's not clear what political utility this really serves or policy benefit it really procures. The only argument I've heard is, hey, other presidents have abused power in the same way. And they'd be absolutely right. George W. Bush did it. Obama did it. Biden did it. Clinton did it. You know, Poppy Bush did it. There is a long litany, sadly, in the post-Cold War era of American presidents murdering people overseas without due process of law, without constitutional authority, without congressional authorization, without a self-defense justification. But that, to me, saying, hey, I come in a long line litany of criminal actors, is not a good justification or rationalization.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's just exactly where I wanted to go next, because here we're going to have Senator Lindsey Graham was asked some of these questions, and he issues forth a couple of rhetorical questions. You can pick them up at the end of this, and I'd like your view on the legality and the justification of his statements.
President Trump told me that he plans to brief members of Congress when he gets back from Asia about future potential military operations against Venezuela and Colombia. So there will be a congressional briefing. Is it illegal for Bush to take Ortega out in Panama? Was it illegal for Reagan to go into Grenada to stop Cuban influence building this big long runway?
Since the War Powers Act of 1973, commander-in-chiefs have used military actions 130 times without any congressional input.
So, I mean, he's right on that last part. That has happened, and I guess it's 137 or 130. Didn't realize it was, but within the issue of law, there is when you're talking about the Supreme Court justices, and they make their rulings, and they say, well, that's precedence, and so now then that's almost the same as law. If you had 130 violations of the law before, does that basically say number 131 is okay?
No, I mean, I can't imagine a mobster making that defense, saying, hey, you know, we've had organized crime here that's committed this crime for 3,000 times before. They weren't prosecuted, so now I get to walk. That's not really the kind of precedent. It's a policy precedent, but it's a policy precedent of illegality that cannot be justified or cannot justify this action. I would further note that, yes, the president did do that meeting with Congress, but they decided to exclude Democrats from it, which suggests that we're definitely going into Venezuela, a high likelihood of it now. But what it also is it undermines the ability to have meaningful congressional authorization or consultation when you exclude one party from the consultation. So that too is, I think, ill-advised. I think what Trump is banking on is political opposition to drugs in the United States and the fact that Congress has been so AWOL and absconded from its authority for so long. But that is not legal or constitutional precedent. We violated people's civil rights after the Civil War, the Southern states from 1880 until 1965 or so. That didn't make it any more legal or constitutional, their deprivation and denial of Black people, their equal civil rights within the Southern states. The same is true here. The president is not on good constitutional authority. I'm sure he's got lawyers that have said, hey, it's been going on for forever, so go ahead and do it. Because, you know, in an era of people like, you know, John Woo and others, you know, the Boltons of the world are writing your strategies and ideas and theories, then you're going to get a green light. But the Constitution only gives a red light. And the past policy and precedent doesn't convert that red light into a green light, not from a legal or constitutional perspective.
Well, and let's look at the two issues he specifically raised, because he says, yeah, we took out Ortega in Panama and Noriega in Grenada with Reagan. And he said, was those illegal? And as I've looked at them, I mean, I think maybe the answer is yes. I think both of them violated both the 73 War Powers Act and the Constitution. How do you see it?
No question. I do love the fact that Lady Lindsey Graham, the queen of the war whores, always inviting us into his brothel of blood, gets Ortega and Noriega confused.
That's a good one.
He's like, oh, it's a different Latin leader. I keep getting confused which ones we've overthrown, which ones we've got involved in. We tried to overthrow Ortega a couple of times. That just shows we went into Grenada because we had just got bombed in Beirut. Reagan pulled us out and he wanted to look good for local domestic political consumption without looking weak after the withdrawal from Beirut. But it's noteworthy that he withdrew from Beirut. He didn't double down in Beirut. Reagan made a wise decision on that side of the aisle. But the Noriega invasion was completely illicit, illegal, unconstitutional. It also didn't produce any reduction in drug supply in the United States. Noriega, of course, had been a long-standing CIA asset, a Poppy Bush asset. I mean, it's like watching a Clancy book or movie come right to life. You know, it was the old Harrison Ford movie where the president's obsessed with drugs and he authorizes illicit illegal action. And Harrison Ford's character, stands up to him. We're re-experiencing it all over again. And why we think this is going to be productive or profitable for long-term policy is beyond me. And they've done polls and surveys in the United States. Americans do not support an intervention in Venezuela. And what this usually produces, as Colonel McGregor has pointed out, as others have pointed out, you have a long border along the water. You have long borders with two other nations that are currently hostile to us in Brazil and Colombia. We have all kinds of paramilitaries and gangs that are authorized there. And TDA would love it if Maduro was taken out, because they would be able to fill the power vacuum in Venezuela. That, Maduro effectively expelled them, or large parts of them. Some believe he did so deliberately to the U.S. as kind of payback for the sanctions. But either way, you would take Maduro out, that the most likely group to fill that vacuum with the power connections to do so is TDA. We likely
almost certainly the United States is grooming this woman who is the opposition leader that just won the Nobel Peace Prize of all things. I'm pretty sure that she would be the one that would be put into position of power here. But you're saying that may be who's at the head of the org chart. But you're saying the actual power itself would be the TDA.
Yeah, most likely, because, I mean, they were effectively kicked out and reduced their footprint substantially in Venezuela by the Maduro regime. That's partially how he got reelected, even though we pretend he didn't get reelected. But, putting that aside. And then, a great way to pick, if you're going to be in the political betting market to the Nobel Peace Prize, pick the regime change person, because that's who they love these days for Nobel Peace Prizes. The Belarusian one a few years ago. I mean, it's a crock. Somebody made a bunch of money just by trolling going through their website and discovered that they actually predict who's going to do it before it goes public. They were able to find it out and make a bunch of money in the poly market and other political markets. But, she's a joke. She's a complete joke. The last president of Venezuela, I think, is hanging out, the president of Venezuela, according to the United States, hanging out in Miami teaching somewhere, Juan Guaido. Trump was more honest in his first term. He had Elliot Abrams running the show. So it was like, in case you had any doubts about what our intentions were, it's pretty obvious. But that effort failed. This effort's also going to fail. And it's far more likely to produce chaos, refugee crises, more migration problems, an explosion of violence and anarchy, and a rise in the importation of drugs, not the decrease of it. There's no historical example that I know of in modern history where our efforts to regime change a country surrounding drugs or any other public policy redounded or rebounded to our benefit. It is, as President Monroe said all the way back in 1823, this usually doesn't work as intended.
And it seems like that we are really trying to double down on this. And now we have this is actually about a little over a month ago, we had Secretary of State Marco Rubio come in late and say, hey, if anybody has any doubts, that darn Maduro, he's totally illegitimate.
Not only do we not recognize him, 50-something countries around the world do not recognize Nicolas Maduro as the rightful president. He's not the president of Venezuela. That's a title he's given himself. And that's not just us saying it. That was, that was the policy of the Biden administration. And that was the policy of the first Trump administration. And that's the policy of 50-something countries, including multiple countries in the region, do not recognize him as the president of that country. What he is someone who's empowered himself of some of the instruments of government and are using that to operate a drug cartel from Venezuelan territory. Much of that drug's aimed at reaching the United States here. He's indicted. He's a fugitive of American justice. There's a reward out for his capture. And by the way, related to that, the President of the United States made clear that he's not going to allow cartels, that cartel or any other cartel, to operate with impunity in our hemisphere and send drugs towards the United States. And he's going to use the U.S. military and all the elements of American power to target cartels.
Do we have the legal authority to say we're going to target the cartels because they are sending illicit drugs in? And I think we can agree that there are cartels. They do things that are harmful to our interest. Does the president have the authority to use military power to go after those networks?
There isn't within the Constitution or really within any congressional framework using the U.S. military to execute, say, arrest warrants, which is what the pitch is here. I also don't think that's a great precedent to set. You know, what happens if other nations start issuing arrest warrants for our leaders? You know, then we're in just a constant problem and constant conflict unnecessarily frequently. Now, much of what Narco Marco said there, for those that don't know his reputation or history, just look up Cocaine Cowboys and the Rubio family, and you discover how they went from blue collar to the kid going to law school. So, you know, Rubio does have some understanding, you might say, of the drug trade and drug trafficking, like a good number of the Cubans that came in during that time period connected to the Batista regime. The allegations, I mean, Venezuela did actually win that election, in my opinion, from the independent election observers. But, you know, by that logic, someone could have declared an arrest warrant, say, on Joe Biden and had him and invaded the country to take him to another country on the grounds that they believe Trump really won the 2020 election. You know, this is not a good precedent to start getting into establishing, but it is not predicated on law. Their only policy precedent for this is what happened with Noriega. And people should study what happened in Panama as to what afterwards. Did that turn to our benefit or did it actually not at all turn to our benefit? And so it's the same logic, is the same distorted logic, the same regime change logic we have constantly and consistently employed in the post-Cold War era. And so far, what Trump said before was right. He was like, why do we keep doing regime change to these people? We might not like these people, but we can deal with them. Usually the consequences of removal, like Syria today, where we're shaking hands with a guy we had a $10 million warrant on, and now we're shaking hands and sending him money. So, you know, it's embarrassing from a constitutional and legal perspective, but also I think from a global political and policy perspective, because it's President Trump walking back his own promises, breaking his own oath to the voters to have no more regime change conflicts, to not be involved in constant continuous foreign interventions. And I think this will politically backfire. Now, legally, will he ever face any real consequence with either Congress or the courts? Highly unlikely, because we've sadly turned a blind eye to the Constitution when it goes to these foreign interventions.
So let's look at one other thing that Secretary Rubio said there. He basically is making the argument that, now you say your assessment is that the election was legal, but let's just for the moment, sake of argument, let's say that it actually wasn't, that he actually fraudulently took power and he only won 30% of the vote, which is what I think he alleges. Does the United States have the right to go and kill the leader of a country because he wasn't legally elected? Because that's the argument he's making.
In essence, it is, as a manner of executing an arrest warrant. And there's no, with lethal force, effectively, there's no constitutional predicate for it. There's no congressional predicate for it. There's no court adjudicated precedent for it beyond what happened with Noriega, where the courts turned a blind eye to how we obtained.
But let's look at the international law. Is there any international law that says that a country can go after the leader of another country if that other country leader wasn't legally elected?
Not that I'm aware of. And if we were going to apply that, there's one leader above all right now that's involved in a major conflict causing major issues around the world who is not elected to office. And his name is Zelensky in Ukraine. So if we're going to suddenly be concerned about democracy, let's start with Ukraine and Zelensky rather than Venezuela and Maduro.
And now look at that same question from American legal aspect, the U.S. Constitution, our federal laws. Does it authorize the president to literally go and kill somebody of another country because we have calculated that they're not legal? I mean, is there a law that they can cite that says, yes, this authorizes us to do that?
No, there's no such law. And as President Trump admitted, he's not even going to try to seek it, which is, you know, an extraordinary claim. the the only way we could go in and execute Maduro is if we had substantial evidence that he presents an imminent risk to the security and safety of the United States of America, by which a proportionality, which is another principle of self-defense, requires us, gives us as our only option, arrest or execution. There, I've seen no evidence yet that that is the case.
Yeah, and so it kind of starts to look like it's just rule by power. We'll do what we want because we can, and who's going to stop us? And that's kind of one of the questions I want to ask you, sort of as a wrap up to all the things we're talking about here. If we take action that is demonstrably extrajudicial or just in violation of our own laws, and there's no consequence, there's no one's going to hold them to account, they just continue to do it, doesn't that continue to shred the entire rule of law across the board, not just in this one area?
It absolutely does. I mean, increasingly, it's not rule of law, it's rule of lawyers. And it's lawyers who just make things up as they go along. And, you know, the old golden rule, he with the gold rules. It's ruling from power, and that's it. And it's not from principle. And by abandoning the principle, we abandon the American foundation. The whole principle of the Monroe Doctrine is we're going to have certain principles we stick with, and no matter the excuse or pretext, we're not going to violate or offend those principles. And yet that is precisely what we are now doing. And by doing so, we damage and destroy. The precedent we're setting is one that destroys American credibility around the world and increasingly weakens American credibility domestically. Because after all the fake excuses we've had to engage in all these wars and conflicts, when it comes out 5, 10, 20 years later that it was fake, that it was fraudulent, that it was fictitious, that it was exaggerated, the American people lose confidence and credibility in their own government and in their own military actions. And so all it does is undermine and sabotage us globally and undermine and sabotage us domestically whenever we abandon the constitutional principles our founders established.
And what do you think is going to happen if history is any guide? In the midterm elections coming up, usually the office, when you have all three branches of government, the next time there's an election, House, Senate, and White House, then you lose the House. So, it's about a razor's edge anyway, and there's plenty of reason why it should go over. But in the event that it does, then it seems like that's going to open up a whole slew of problems to potentially, as you said a second ago, open up President Trump to more impeachment proceedings. And of course, that will immediately be said, oh, just like the last time you impeached him over all this nonsense and stuff. What are your concerns that this might do to the legal foundation of our country if the legal and the political get so mixed up that you can't tell one from the other?
Increasingly, that's what it looks like. That's why, many of us warned against crossing various red lines that Democrats chose to do in TDS, such that now they won't have the same degree of credibility, even if they have legitimate constitutional qualms with the president's behavior towards Venezuela. If we go in, I think he also risked domestically losing the libertarian and anti-war portions of his base, which are very big amongst Mexican-Americans in the Southwest and industrial Midwest blue-collar workers. And those are the swing districts in the House, the swing states in the Senate. And for a future presidential campaign of J.D. Vance would be substantially impaired and undermined by this as well, since those are the key states in a presidential election. So he's already been bleeding out those votes with not getting the Ukrainian conflict resolved, by getting constantly dragged into the Israel's latest conflict with somebody someplace somewhere. And now we're into the regime change, banana republic regimes of the past. And he looks more and more like there's the picture of Trump, that the new portrait for Trump 47 is going to be a hybrid of George W. Bush and Donald Trump. He increasingly looks that way. And I don't think that's good politics for him personally or the Republican Party. And then what you're likely to get is impeachment hearings that have actually more merit, more evidentiary foundation than all the past bogus ones did. That could drag out for months and months, derail the second half of his second administration in such a way he's not able to achieve much of anything. And the question is Maduro worth all of that? I have yet to hear a political argument, just from a pure political reasoning, why Maduro is worth the president sabotaging the second half of his second term, getting ground down into a ceaseless impeachment proceedings over whether he went about this conflict in a constitutionally correct way.
Yeah, to the extent that you have some views on this, Because I have been just really trying to just scratch my head and try to figure out where the value is in even going down this path with so much gusto that he seems to be going down. Because, I mean, you had Maduro basically hand over all the oil on a silver platter and just offer to do whatever he wants. And I don't know if you saw that reaction of Trump when he was asked that. He actually used the F word on live on television on that. It made him so angry. And I thought, wait a minute. He's basically, all these threats of military power had their effect. He's ready to hand over, you know, a control of a lot of this oil, which many said that's probably the reason before. But if that's not the objective, what is?
It increasingly looks like a sort of Grenada and Noriega on steroids, where it's not really about the resources, even because Maduro, as you note, and as Trump has acknowledged, has offered up all those resources. You want to come in for the rare earths? Come on in. You want the emeralds? You want the gold? You want the oil? Come on
Incredible.
In. You know, open invitation. He literally gave away the store. He just wants to sustain the Bolivarian revolution as he understands it in Venezuela, but he's willing to give up those resources. And part of that is because they haven't really develop the oil resource as well. Yeah. There was a lot of mismanagement by both Hugo Chavez and Maduro about managing their currency and managing the oil development. So he's open to replacing, because I heard different excuses. Oh, it's about replacing China and Russia. He's already given that up. Maduro's already given that up. And yet we're going to forfeit that just so we can put in our own little tin cup dictator there who is not deeply popular, who, if anybody studied the history of these political movements, I mean, FARC is right on the border and goes back and forth between Colombia and Venezuela all the time. They would be happy to work with TDA and the rest at creating a completely chaotic anarchistic state in Venezuela, which then we're not going to be getting any oil out of there. So it is utterly baffling beyond just being narco Marcos policy that Trump is just deferring to. You have Soros, Scotty Bessent dictating financial policy globally. Hence, you get the Russophobic mindset and mishandling of the Chinese negotiations that we got from Bessent. We're seeing the same thing with he's letting Narco Marco run his foreign policy. Little Marco, with his Napoleonic complex, who's always been obsessed with regime change everywhere, but especially in Latin America. From his Cuban origins and Cuban roots, that runs very deep. But they did a poll survey of the Venezuelans and Cubans in Miami and asked them, are you for a military intervention in Venezuela? And they said no. That's how unpopular it is, because they realize that doesn't usually end well. That script has a certain same ending. You can change the preview. You can change the prediction. You can change the trailer. It's going to end the same way, and it's usually disaster for America.
Maduro offered everything in his country, all the natural resources. He even recorded a message to you in English recently offering mediation.
He has offered everything. He's offered everything. You're right. You know why? Because he doesn't want to fuck around with the United States.
And then I guess Trump just says, yeah, well, but we're going to anyway. So
it feels like ego. It feels like I described that, we're seeing the death throes of the old neocon deep state American empire. That is coming out, that is dying, screaming in anguish, pretending it. I think Trump pretended he had leverage with China. Turned out he didn't. Pretended he had leverage with Russia. Turns out he didn't. Pretended he had leverage with Iran. Turns out he didn't. So I think that he wants to show, we're still big. We're still important. We can take out this little country over here. Same reason why Reagan went into Grenada. Oh, yeah, we're still big, even though we're running away from the Middle East because that policy badly backfired and the deaths of hundreds of Marines. We're going to take down Grenada. Yeah, there we go. And now we're going to take down Caracas. And it's more like he wants to show off American power. Like he recently said, well, we're going to do nuclear weapons testing, too, because look at these Russian nuclear weapons that we don't have an answer for. But he doesn't want to admit that publicly. Instead, he wants to pretend we have more nukes than they do. They've had long more nukes than us since the 70s, but the independently confirmed all over the place. It feels like an old man. It's like the boomer con side of Trump is coming out watching too much Fox. That's what your brain on too much Fox looks like. It ends up looking like Trump 47. And he wants to show off to say, no, we still matter. We still have power. And it's like, this is a fruitless, futile way to express that power. Our founders understood the best way we express that power is by being the light and flame of liberty for the rest of the world, not by going abroad, searching for monsters to destroy. And all Trump wants to do is show off his machismo by finding monsters to destroy.
Yeah, and let's just start cutting that list down. But it looks like they're trying to expand it. They're all the focus so far that we've been talking about here, especially and most of it in the public realm here, has been on Venezuela for obvious reasons. But in that comment, in that soundbite from Lindsey Graham a second ago, he added in that Trump is thinking about military power in Venezuela and Colombia. And he said, he's going to be talking to us then. I hadn't seen that conversation had already happened. But why do you suppose that, where in the world is Colombia being thrown into this mix, when at least up until just a number of months ago, Colombia had pretty good relations with the United States, regardless of what policy was or party was in power?
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. Now, I mean, if you want to deal with cocaine, Colombia kind of makes sense. But Colombia can't get control of its cocaine supply. We're going to suddenly get control of our cocaine supply. But I think the Colombian president, that escalated after the Colombian president went out and made some inflammatory statements towards Trump. I get it. It's machismo against machismo, you know, very Latino style. But, you know, these are bad hombres, as Trump would like to say. But all dragging us into these foreign interventions is going to do, and what it usually leads to, is more chaos, more immigration problems, more refugee problems. I mean, like, people are complaining about the SNAP benefits and all the refugees that are on those SNAP benefits. But it's, why are they refugees in the first place? Because of America's stupid wars. That's why. Otherwise, they wouldn't even be here to have that problem presented to us. And it's the same logic he's going down. And it's like he's trying to become like a Cadillo of the 1950s or something. I mean, people forget a lot of the drug trade all really started when we decided to help Klaus Barbie with Pinochet and the rest in Bolivia in the late 1970s, early 80s, as a DEA agent stumbled across in the mid 80s in Argentina. We created this problem ourselves, and now we're going to blame everybody else for it. But it's a really weak, lame pretext and fig leaf for trying to say America's still strong, America's still powerful, America's still the best, by picking on some small country that can't put up a meaningful fight that is only going to lead to our own political problems back at home.
And speaking of problems back at home, and in the last bit of time we have here, what is your assessment of how this would play with the MAGA supporters? A lot of folks, we've had some on our channel here, absolutely voted for Trump because he was talking about, I don't want any more stupid wars, we don't want regime change, all those things. And now then, I mean, he claims that he's ended seven wars, or eight wars, I guess, is what he's claiming now. The one in the Middle East is not even an end of a war. It's a ceasefire with a hostage exchange, and all the details, difficult part, hadn't even been negotiated yet. Obviously, anything with the Russia-Ukraine war is heading towards a Russian military victory, so no end in that one. But then now that you're talking about over here, you could be literally starting one. And Lindsey Graham also said that he thought this would be a layup. A regime change war would be a layup. I should kid you not. It won't be. And so what is going to happen to – well, let's just look at it from a couple of angles. First of all, from the MAGA supporters, what are they going to do if, instead of ending all these wars, he doesn't end the really big ones and then he starts another one in our own backyard?
I mean, I think the part of his base, there's a part of his base that's kind of boomer con, America, F yeah, kind of routine, those sort of, you know, I call it fake machismo. Those people will be fine and satisfied with it. And the people that are like hardcore Trump loyalists, that Trump can do no wrong, they'll be okay with it. The problem is that's not the 100% of his base. And, you know, I call politics, as Kevin Phillips described it, it's math. You know, are you adding or subtracting? And if you're subtracting, by golly, you better be adding more than you're subtracting. All Trump is doing with these policies is subtracting. He's not adding anybody that's going to suddenly turn around and be a supporter on the Democratic side of the aisle. Instead, he's giving the Democratic Party back its capacity to become the anti-war party again, which will boost them politically, domestically in the United States. And it's already showing up in some of the Virginia and New Jersey gubernatorial elections that are, and New York City mayor's elections that are upcoming. You're sort of young, low propensity MAGA voter, low propensity meaning they don't always vote. They're not turning out in these elections. That a chance at winning the New Jersey governorship is probably already done because of these foreign policy adventurism. And so I think it will continue to sabotage and undermine his own base. It will also destroy his legacy. I think he's obsessed with, you know, legacy. He wants to be known as the peace president. And maybe the ticket is, hey, if I start eight new wars and then solve them, I can say I solved eight wars. You know, that really, kind of like our Iran deal, kind of like, I mean, how do you take credit for peace in Iran when we bombed them? Okay. So it seems to be, he has been misled down a perilous path Swampy Susie is his chief of staff. She comes from the old Reagan era, big corporate lobbyist, deep ties to the military-industrial complex. And he's ended up facilitating the very group that he was empowered and elected to defeat. And it will depress and distress a good portion of his base. And it will undermine the Republicans in the near short term. But I don't think it will defeat the rise of populism and anti-war sentiment in the United States or the world. It will reinforce it. And they'll just find another mechanism and means of expressing that anti-war sentiment, whether it's another party, whether it's another candidate or someone else. Because all this will do is reinforce what those of us that have said we should be our constitutional republic, not this deep state-driven foreign policy, have been saying when they see that this turn into a debacle and disaster like all the other ones have.
Well, let me just dovetail off what you just said there, because that's something that has a lot of interest to me, and something I cover here on the channel periodically, and that is the political dysfunction here. I mean, I my particular personal view is this whole government shutdown is just another example of the pathetic debauchery of the two-party system, that they can't solve anything. They love to throw rocks at each other, and they don't seem to care anything about the people in between that are solved, because this problem could literally be solved in an afternoon if they just got into a room, but they don't. Now, you made a comment there a second ago I wanted to go down. You said one of these days, whether it's this or something else, could potentially cause a rise to where a third party might be considered possible. Now, up to this point, that anytime there's been talk about a third party, it's always like, well, all you're going to do is drag votes away from this party or that party, or people are still say, well, for all its flaws, it's still going to, we still have to have two party. But are you suggesting we may finally be coming to a point to where, no, the disgust may be high enough to actually form a third party?
Yeah, my view was Trump was the last chance of the two-party system to prove its sustainability in the future of American politics. And if Trump fails to deliver on things like his opposition to war, then I think that it will show that the two-party system is so bankrupt and so broke, people have no choice but to seek out a third-party option. And third parties usually change the debate and dialogue in American politics, even when they don't gain power, by forcing one of the other two parties to adopt the positions and policies of that third party. But what may happen here is that America tends to parallel the politics of the UK. And right now what's happening in the UK is the two parties that have dominated for more than a century in that country may not even exist in 5 years, in the Tories and Labour, being completely replaced by reform, solely because reform is at least outside the system. What the system saw in Boris Johnson was those Midlands voters unhappy with Labour found themselves equally unhappy with the Tories and said, no more, no mas, we want complete revolutionary change. And usually American politics is not far behind what you're seeing in the UK, whether you're Margaret Thatcher previewed Ronald Reagan, you know, John Major previewed Poppy Bush, Tony Blair mirrored Bill Clinton in the rise of neoliberalism. All of that shows the key is going to be Trump delivering to this constituency, or the two-party system will have proven to the American people it is no longer a viable mechanism of political governance. And I think, and then you have people lurking in the side who are talking about the possibility, who could, because of their individual resources and platform ownership, take a third party and make it popular overnight. And that's, of course, Elon Musk. When the richest man in the world is like, maybe we need a third party. And if Trump continues to fail, he may say, I should go back and revisit that third party idea. And all of a sudden, then you could have a whole different political dynamic in the United States. Historically, when our two parties fail, third parties do emerge.
And one would imagine, if that scenario you painted a second ago, that we get bogged down into something here, the Republicans do lose the House, the Democrats get it, and it turns into this just morass of all this investigations and another impeachment or who knows what, that will seem to even deepen the idea that the Democrats aren't a viable alternative, and they better find a third one or we're going to be in trouble. I mean, how do you see it?
Oh, that's exactly right. And the Democrats, by not embracing the anti-war message that Trump is gifting them on their plate, is proving to their own voters, oh, this system doesn't work. Our parties neither party works for those that want a different foreign policy, that want a different domestic focus of our domestic leaders. And I think that's we saw it, like the rise of the Jeffersonian movement was in response to the failure of the first early parties. Same with the Jacksonian movement. Same with the Abraham Lincoln Republican Party movement. Same with the populists at the end of the 19th century, progressives at the early beginning of the 20th century. People like Upton Sinclair making surges in a wide range of places. In fact, you can go back and look in the South and you'll find overlaps between Upton Sinclair support and Donald Trump support, which may shock some people in modern age, but that gives you an idea. These are deeply rooted protest-driven voter constituencies and communities. And if they can't find expression through the within the two-party system, which is what Trump is educating them on with his attacks on Thomas Massey, if he's actually successful at that, the message to the libertarians will be, we can no longer work within the two-party apparatus. And he's teaching them the wrong lesson if he wants to sustain the Republican Party brand long-term. So I think that if Trump continues down this perilous deep state path of foreign policy that he was elected to overturn, the American people will say we have no choice but to seek out a third party option.
And other than Elon Musk, do you see any other nascent movements that might get some interest from anybody, or is it too early?
It probably is, but I'd say someone like Thomas Massey is someone to watch. If someone like we also see in South Carolina, Lady Lindsey Graham is being contested by Paul Dance. Paul Dan's, great populist, deeply anti-war guy, anti-establishment guy. If he's able to win within the Republican primary apparatus and Massey's able to hold on against the primary challenges funded by big billionaires against him, then that would give some faith to those anti-war constituencies that they can have success within their own parties. If they're unsuccessful and unavailing, then those constituencies will say, we have no choice. We've been kicked out of the House. So we have no choice but to look for a new house to occupy, a new place of shelter for our political views and beliefs. And I think we're seeing in other parts around the world, whether it's Le Pen's rise in France, whether it's the AfD in Germany, you're seeing countries that have share certain political trends with us saying the third party, a new party option has to be the only way we will be able to get the political change we keep voting for, but not getting.
Fascinating. Well, that's very interesting. I'd love to have you back on in the future to go down this path in a little bit more detail, because I certainly am sold on that fact. And I'm disgusted with the two-party system, and I can't imagine I'm the only one. So I'd love to hear some of your views on a future show.
Absolutely.
Well, but listen, but really appreciate you providing such clarity on these issues today, because look, I mean, the bottom line is, a lot of people are not just anti-war, but just anti-stupid war. And I'm a former four-time combat veteran, and I'm all about a strong national defense, but I am emphatically against adventurism, which will be going on. And I think there's a lot of people for that. And I really appreciate you clarifying the legality issue so people don't get too lost in the weeds about, well, just because of the narrative that something is legal when it's not, because we better continue to understand we're need to be a country governed by the rule of law, or we're going to be in trouble one of these days. And let's hope we don't get to that point. But thank you so much for coming on today. And our pleasure. And thank you very much for you guys coming on to us. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't so far. Helps us more than you may know. Look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.